This edition of Culture with Robert Bound was first broadcast on the 10th of February 2014 on Monocle 24. Hello and welcome to the 122nd edition of Culture with me, Robert Bound. We're going multidisciplinary this week. We're narrowing our eyes to get the picture in focus, travelling from pillar to post to make sense of the new, lending our ears out to all manner of things. Things like these. We get an audience with Nils Frahm, the highly favoured piano virtuoso who doesn't care for genres but has made a book for his music that's very definitely a book.
It would be nice if Bach would have taken the time and be like, hey, and maybe play it in this or that way, and be sure not to rush things. And it's all things you can't really put in the actual sheet music with all the symbols you're using.
Talking of which, ever wonder where all those publishers of coffee table bothering art and photography books gather for a beer? At the Art Book Fair in Los Angeles, that's where.
We don't want to just look at stuff on our computer all day, every day. We want something that we can put on our bookshelf. We want objects. We want the interaction of paper and ideas and people.
And as Tehran's Fajj Film Festival wraps up, we'll get a lesson in the history of Iranian cinema.
I mean, we've heard all the stories. Even prior to the revolution, there was a film that was smuggled out of Iran to Venice. The film that's often considered the first film of the Iranian New Wave, so 1969.
Plus, as this year's Oscars loom ever closer, we'll ask whether crowdfunding website Kickstarter's impact on the industry can finally be measured. We'll get the lowdown on the recent India art fair in New Delhi and cozy up with analogue recording artists Sap for our live Midori House session. It's going to be a busy hour here on Culture with me, Robert Bound, on Monocle 24, so fasten your seatbelts. What do you mean, what comes first? We'll have some music and then we'll go and visit Nils Frahm at his piano. This week's Midori House session comes to us courtesy of Sap, a group from London who've carved a niche making rather hypnotic albums from homemade sounds. A bit of suitcase percussion here, a rubber duck sound effect there. For their fourth album, What Makes Us Glow, the band took up residence in a castle. Maybe it's the only place that would have them and all their instruments. Here they are for us in session last week at Midori House with Wet Salt.
Don't let it
That was Sap with Wet Salt, and we'll have more from them and their Casio keyboards later on in the show. This is Culture with me, Robert Bounds, and weren't we lucky to get Nils Frahm onto the show this week. If you don't know him, we should say yet to discover him. He's a Berlin-based piano virtuoso and composer, arranger and collaborator whose work elegantly straddles those troublesome labels: contemporary classical, jazz, avant-garde and whatever else just ain't pop. His intimate spare piano pieces seem to have an ageless yet modern aesthetic, and now they have an artifact that almost looks like it sounds. Sheets is Nils Frahm's first book, the scores to some of his pieces, interspersed by abstract photography by his onstage light designer Stuart Bales, all perfectly printed on thick paper stock with beautifully bound linen hard covers. Almost sounds like a spoof Monocle artifact, doesn't it? The irony? Nils Frahm can't read music. Nils launched the book last week at the Different Gallery in London, and I went with open ears and asked, why write it down?
First of all, it's kind of a time-consuming thing to do. I never was intrigued to try it myself. I had hard enough time reading sheet music to start with, and so I invented my own setup to write my ideas down, which is basically just chords with some signs I use for certain voicings or certain ideas I usually have. And it's kind of a shortcut, but it's also less detailed than actual sheet music, for sure. But that kind of, I see that as an advantage because I don't like to play a piece exactly the same.
So every time you play differently because I guess it's in your head, right?
Yeah, there's like a basic structure in my head and then I just connect the general dots and fill up the space with something I make up in that moment. I mean, the fun part about that is that you don't get bored of your pieces easily. Because I played in some more straightforward pop and rock bands, and we would play a tour and play the same set every night, pretty much bar by bar, the same thing. And that's not particularly exciting. So that's an advantage. And the other advantage is I don't need to learn the pieces, really. I can kind of keep them in disguise.
Keep them in disguise, that's a good way. And next time someone says, you don't know what you're doing, I'll say, I'm keeping it in disguise.
Right. Sounds more advanced.
It sounds great. I like that. Let's get some t-shirts made. And there's two things about the aesthetic of the book. I mean, I guess your personal taste has decided what it looks like. You open it and it is a flash of red on the front page or inside the front page. It's a very sort of beautiful artifact. But also the notes on the bars, there's a sort of aesthetic to those as well. Do you have any interest in what the music looks like written down? The stuff that came out of nowhere into your head, went onto the piano keys and is now on paper. Do you have an insight into the aesthetic of it?
The aesthetic. I'm deep into artists like Alvar Noto, for example, who worked with different kind of notations. And he's crossing notating music with design. And also the art of typography is basically the same thing. It's purposeful because you can read words when you write them down. But on the surface, they also have an appearance which you might like or find fitting for its context or content. And or you might think they're not fitting. And for me, it's very important that the typography for my albums, for example, and everything, the whole aesthetic is something which resonates with my taste. I also put in music and I feel like it's everything matters. And also like where the bar exactly ends and how the bar ends in the next page, or is it looking good overall when you just look at it as an image? And it should be good looking that way too. And that's what we try to achieve. And I'm really, really happy with what especially Thorsten Posselt, who was designing the book, did on final touches in terms of perfectionizing the book. There's no flaw in the book. There's not one single thing I see which could be better. And this I never had with my own albums. You know.
That's an amazing thing. Yeah. So you mean the look and feel of this thing, that your music that's become an artifact?
Yeah, usually there's like one word written wrong, or like there's one comma, one point or something wrong, but nothing in this case. It's amazing, almost magical.
So there's a sense in this of, like in writing or in painting, that with musical composition and playing, you've got to be able to do it right, to do it wrong well.
Yeah.
People who do it wrong well are always the creative ones, right?
Yeah, every classical recording you hear, there are some notes in there which are not written down in the sheets, mm-hmm. because the player played a wrong one, but he is so probably experienced that he can make it work.
Styling it out.
Yeah. Or playing it in the same repetition also wrong again, so it sounds like it's purposeful. And not everybody knows how the score exactly looks, so that's totally fine. There's some classical policemen who are right on beautiful YouTube clips from some classical playing. Isn't there a wrong note at bar 76 at minute 5:26? You know, and I find that very disgusting. Those people should shut up forever.
I wanted to ask you about some of the notations that you've written. You've written some paragraphs on the pieces inside, on your compositions. You've got a very nice tone of voice here. It's rare to hear composers writing about their music in a personal way and with a slightly arched eyebrow. Where does that come from? Is that something? Are you sometimes itching to write about something that you've made? Do the words and the music kind of come from the same place in your head?
I think there's always something lacking in what they do. And I imagine that when I put some words, some personal words, in context with the artifact I'm producing, then it might help the content to not be misunderstood. And on the other note, I would love to read some personal notes from Bach to their fugue. You know, it would be nice if Bach would have taken the time and be like, hey, and maybe play it in this or that way, and be sure not to rush things, and maybe at the middle of the piece change the tempo a little bit. It's all things you can't really put in the actual sheet music with all the symbols you're using.
At the front of sheets, your book sheets, there's some nice drawings. It gets a bit IKEA catalogue, but in a handsome way at the front. You're inviting people to mess with their pianos. Well, this is a budget damper, but there's a way of vamping up the piano. What's all this about?
I thought if the book is $60, there should be a budget damper version in it, because you spend all the money you had for a real damper on the book. I collect old recording gear, and sometimes I get the original manuals. And these original manuals are all hand-painted. And I kind of like how they paint the synthesizer in exactly that fashion. I'm not really sure what you would call that style of painting. But I think it's technical painting. So it's technical paintings of a piano, and like it has like almost like a comic, different steps how you can modify a piano to get different kind of sounds out of them. And I thought it would be generous to share that it's possible to do that with only three old t-shirts, for example, just to get the people curious about what else they could do with a piano. Somebody might start with three t-shirts, but then he has a really great idea what else you could put in front of it.
Well, I think we should end on the joke that has clearly been on all our listeners' lips, which is, it sounds like they're moving pianos upstairs, but they actually are. Nils Frahm, thank you very much for your time. A literal way of translating music for the eyes. That was Nils Frahm, whose book Sheets is out now. To get yourself a copy, just visit nilsfrahm.com. And for those just joining us, you're listening to Culture with me, Robert Bound. art books, by which I mean artists' books, art catalogues, monographs, periodicals and zines, have become an increasingly popular medium in recent decades. There are fairs all over the world celebrating them, including those in Tokyo, London, Paris and New York, where distributor and publisher Printed Matter has been running an event for the past 8 years. It's been so successful that in 2013 they branched out to the West Coast, and recently thousands of people returned to enjoy the second annual Los Angeles Art Book Fair. We sent reporter Jed Kim to take a stroll around the stalls.
The fair, which is free to the public, is housed at the Geffen Contemporary in Los Angeles' Little Tokyo district. Inside, it's a maze of white walls, acting as canvases for the 260 exhibitors displaying their wares. There's a lot to see.
I think in 2 years, the LA fair has got to the size of the New York fair. I mean, in New York, it's slowly built into this big, huge event, and it took us 8 years to do. LA is just pretty much boom straight away. We've been really lucky.
Shannon Michael Kane works for Printed Matter and is the curator of the fair. He says exhibitors have come from 26 countries to be here. And then there are the attendees.
We've doubled our attendance every day. So last year, I think we were just under 15,000, and it's, if we keep on creeping up the way we are, it's going to be like 20,000. At least, so.
What were you expecting?
Well, last year, Mocha were like saying like 5,000 or 6,000. So we got like almost 10,000 more people attending than what they expected. So,
what's the appeal of an art book? Kane says they originated as retaliation against the traditional system of art shows. Instead of waiting for galleries to recognize them, artists began crafting books to display their work, a sort of portable exhibition. Kane says that the reactionary feel remains today.
Now I think that this boom of independent publishing is like reactionary to blogs and Tumblr, and you know, it's saying like, you know, we don't want to just look at stuff on our computer all day every day. We want something that we can put on our bookshelf. We want objects. We want the interaction of paper and ideas and people.
Another appealing thing about art books is that they're more affordable to collect, and patrons are lining up to buy them. The price tags on these pieces of art vary. In one cavernous room, younger artists sit at tables selling their wares, things like handcrafted zines and cards. At one table, customers rummage through bins filled with small buttons. Each features a tiny piece of street art created by Noah Lyon. Lyon has priced his buttons at $2 a piece, or $7 for $10. He says he's doing well this weekend.
I sell a lot of zines and buttons and shirts and a lot of Noah Lyon product.
The low price point means customers like Scott Vogel can walk away with art he likes.
I don't have a whole lot of money to spend here, but I figure 20, 40 bucks, so I'm trying to get the most bang for my buck and just really gravitate towards things that are well priced, but that I really... really kind of strike me too. This work I like a lot here. Yeah. A lot of great stuff here though.
At another part of the fair, the offerings are a little pricier. This is the antiquarian section, where people flip through rarer, more valuable art books.
Is there like a this size brochure? Is it like Rauschenberg and folks?
Rauschenberg did that Driller's Mud project for it, but yeah, it doesn't really look like that.
Lee Kaplan owns Arcana, which specializes in books on contemporary visual art. Kaplan was here last year for the first fair in Los Angeles. He says this year has been better for exhibitors like him.
I'm very pleased. Last year, no one knew what to expect, and I think the dealers who brought zines or the publishers of less expensive, small print run material, I think did very, very well, and there was a great turnout for that. The rarer, more expensive material, maybe not so much. This year, it seems like there are more people buying that material from us than there were last year. So it's encouraging.
This morning, he sold an exhibition catalog of French artist Yves Klein's first big museum show. It went for $17,500.
That certainly pays for the book and the cost of doing the fair without question. It's a really fantastic thing. It was priced reasonably for what it is, and so one would hope that there would be sophisticated clientele and taste at a fair like this. Amongst, the 20,000 people, probably 200 people who would come who would appreciate that, who might consider buying it if they didn't. So it was an obvious thing for us to want to bring. It was maybe an obvious thing for the right person to buy. We had several things like that last year that didn't sell, so we were very lucky that it did this year.
Other exhibitors tell me they expect that in just a couple of years, the fair will evolve into a great market for higher-end art books. Even so, there will always be a place for the fledgling artist creations, and there will be customers for both. Shannon Sims flew in from Oregon just for this fair. She collects art books, has more than she can count. Sims likes books on landscapes and geography, and is eyeing the selection of antiquarian books at the Arcana booth. She hasn't found anything yet, but then she's only just arrived.
Actually, I just did pick up this postcard set, Kittens and Kale, which is a really amusing like photo series. That's not really typical of the kinds of things I collect, but I thought it was really fun.
It cost her $20, which she says is more than she wanted to spend, but she liked it.
That was Jed Kim reporting for us there from the LA Art Book Fair. You're tuned into Code Share with me, Robert Bound, right here on Monocle 24. Up next, 4 years on, we'll ask how Kickstarter's impacted on the film industry.
The Monocle app has all the details of what's coming up on Monocle 24 and offers you the chance to catch up on the shows you might have missed. You can download programs to your mobile or tablet to listen offline and set reminders for all your favourites. It also has one-tap access to the latest news reports from our editors and correspondents around the world. The 2525 is Monocle's insider guide to the world's premier resort and business cities. The app features recommendations for the best hotels, restaurants, and retail opportunities, along with GPS directions, ensuring Monocle is your one-stop guide to city hopping. You can even give us feedback on personal favourites you've discovered on your travels. The Monocolumn is Instapaper supported and available to read on your mobile, fully integrated to fit any size and screen. The Monocle app is available through iTunes and at monocle.com. Monocle, keeping an eye and an ear on the world.
And welcome back to Culture with me, Robert Bounds. It seems hard to believe now that 4 years ago, the idea that you could contribute to the funding of an arts project or a film from your laptop anywhere in the world was pretty much unheard of. Enter stage left, Kickstarter, the trailblazer of the crowdfunding world. Suddenly, all you needed was a good idea and a well-thought-out pitch video, and you could speak to anyone who's prepared to listen for financial support, revolutionising the way that arts projects were funded. It's not been without its critics and controversy, but all in all, it's been a good few years for the site, most notably in film. Nearly $80 million have been pledged to back various projects over the last 4 years, and this year alone has already seen 19 titles selected for the recent Sundance Film Festival and one Oscar nominee. To find out more about how the site is having an impact on the film business, I spoke to its head of film, Liz Holm.
Millions of Egyptians came down to the streets in nationwide protest.
This uprising defies any definitions.
People are gathering in the largest demonstrations against President Hosni Mubarak.
قرار السيد الرئيس محمد حسني مبارك بالتخلي عن منصب رئيس الجمهورية.
The Square is actually nominated for an Oscar for Best Documentary this year, which is super exciting. And actually, on my commute every day, I pass the Square's poster on the G train subway stop, which is pretty awesome. I just got back from Sundance Film Festival, where there were 20 Kickstarter-funded films there. And we go to celebrate and support those movies. We work with those filmmakers and do things like make postcards for them. We throw a party. I don't know if you've seen the Kickstarter Sundance site, but just try and highlight, you know, and celebrate all these films out in the world.
And you're in an interesting position at Kickstarter because you're often obviously looking at things which haven't been finished yet. You're not a broadcaster or a producer in the sense that you're distributing finished stuff. You're sort of helping to bankroll or enabling the bankrolling of things that are just about to start or need help finishing off. That's kind of the vibe, isn't it? You're becoming a producer, I guess, aren't you?
I actually, outside of Kickstarter, I produce myself, and my last film, Obvious Child, which just premiered at Sundance, we raised finishing funds through Kickstarter. So certainly for a lot of projects, it will be a mix of equity, grants, government funds, and Kickstarter is a piece of the pie. But it really is sort of the community building piece, and it's the piece that helps with your kind of grassroots marketing and outreach and building and really connecting meaningfully with your audience. So filmmakers come to Kickstarter anywhere from development through, you know, distribution. Sometimes they just have an idea. Other times they've made a film and they're raising essentially P&A. There's actually a movie called 8 Minutes Idle that's coming out in the UK next Friday, I think, that sort of raised their distribution funds on Kickstarter. So definitely look out for that one.
I'm about to enjoy a day of true idleness, talking on the telephone. I work in a call center and still live at home.
I wonder if being head of film for Kickstarter, whether that's getting easier or getting more hard with the amount of stuff you're getting sent, you know, whether how quickly, in essence, maybe new Hollywood is becoming old Hollywood and some of the problems that go with that.
I don't know if it's getting easier or harder. I think it's just something that continues to grow and evolve. Like when I first started at Kickstarter, I joined when we were about 15 people and now we're over 70. And when I started, everyone on staff looked at every project that launched every single day. And, you know, I have to say, like, I don't know every single film project that's live on the site anymore. And on the one hand, I'm bummed about that. But on the other hand, I think, like, I'm reading about these projects through press or learning about them through my colleagues or following certain ones myself. I mean, I've backed over 600 films on site at this point, so I'm definitely a Kickstarter-aholic. You know, I think I continue to learn from and with the community, both as a filmmaker and as head of film, as you call it so dauntingly. So we'll see. Yeah, we'll see what's in store.
And just, I just wonder whether you get a sense of, especially when you go to festivals like Sundance, etc., how the rest of Hollywood's reaction to Kickstarter is, to whether they feel like it's an armored vehicle, if not a tank on their lawn.
I think that it's been really interesting to have conversations with big Hollywood, as you say, and see how those conversations have evolved over the last couple years. I mean, I think there's definitely a strong understanding of it as, you know, as I said, like a meaningful community building tool. And we'll talk to agencies where they see it as an opportunity to have first money in, and that's real proof of concept and could inspire big equity to jump in and say, oh, there's really a market for this. There's really people who care about this, or they've got, you know, most of their financing in place and it's just that last piece of the puzzle. And rather than go back and bring more investors to the table or, you know, lose creative freedom or all the reasons why we sort of avoid those things, there's a real opportunity to find that community and freedom through finishing, you know, putting it together through Kickstarter. So I do think there's a real awareness and real excitement. I mean, we're about to see the launch of the Veronica Mars movie next month. And I think obviously people have really been following that. And Zach Braff's film that came out at Sundance was bought by Focus. I think, you know, there's a real understanding that these projects are brought to life because people want them and because people care about them. And I think big Hollywood cares about what people want and care about. So I think there is definitely a lot of enthusiasm around that.
That was Liz Holm, head of film at Kickstarter. Liz's own film, Obvious Child, premiered at Sundance. And if you want to read up on it, yep, you guessed, it's on Kickstarter. Still to come in part two, more live music from SAP. We'll ask whether the India Art Fair has upped its game, and as the 32nd Fajr Film Festival and Market come to a close in Tehran, we'll get a potted history of Iranian film. Three more reasons to stay tuned right here to Culture with me, Robert Bound, on Monocle 24. Time for another track then from our musical guests this week, SAP, the London duo, with little help for their live shows like today, who brought with them an array of unusual instruments to decorate and punctuate their jazz-ish pop. And before I asked them which button they knew how to press and when, here they are with Seven.
You've been my friend, you've been my door, you've been the only thing that I've been looking for. But when you're gone, you leave no trace, only the memory of your face. You take the warmth from my bones. You take away my chance, you take my home. But when you're back, I still don't mind. I am spilling over all the time. No, I didn't know it was gonna go this way. No one ever knew there would be a final day. And however hard we tried to run, we never see how far we've come. There's not a drop, there's not a spark. You have even taken every question back. Though I call, you won't reply. You watch me rooting through each door, you watch me lie. I know I didn't know it was gonna go this way. No one ever knew there would be a final day. And however hard we tried to run, we never see how far we've come.
I'm joined by Galia and Kareem from SAP. Thank you very much for joining us on The Culture Show. Thank you for your lovely Midori House session.
Thank you. You warmed us up in there.
I thought that was a genre of music initially. I forgot that that's the address of this place. And I thought Midori House, that's what it's called now.
Maybe it's a small island in Asia, I suppose.
When you were taking all your instruments out of their cases and their boxes and setting them up, quite a lot of people didn't really know what any of the things were that you had. So you've got to talk us through them. Kareem, you're on the acoustic guitar. That's easy enough.
Nylon string guitar.
Tick. I know what that is.
Okay, good.
I'm not saying I know how to play it. I'm just saying I know what it is. But Galia, you had a kind of an array of stranger instruments.
I did. Well, I had a table and it looked a little bit like I was going to be doing a cookery demonstration because I had a long rectangular table with lots of things on it. But actually, compared with our full live show or being in the studio, it's actually incredibly straightforward what we've got.
Okay.
I've got violin, voice, a Casio keyboard that I got, I think, for my 8th birthday.
It's still going.
And the most exciting instrument, which is the Suzuki Omnicord, which is a bit like a harp. I described it the other day as an idiot's harp because it's really, really easy to play. It's a bit like an auto harp, but an electronic version of an auto harp, if you know what that is.
And I want to know first, when you guys started working together, how you knew that all these sort of weird and wonderful instruments, these unusual instruments anyway, were going to sound good against the template of your voices and your arrangements and stuff.
I think it was a lot of trial and error at the beginning. It's just a more exciting process rather than using any sort of preset sounds to sort of make something up from scratch. Plus, we were a bit poor. We didn't have money for a drum kit or anything. So we had to sort of get rhythms sorted out with objects we had in the house. And I've been working as a sound engineer for at least 10 years before we met. So there are a few tricks how you can sort of create a good rhythm with something worth 5p.
Does that do these things get stuck on afterwards, or are they a sort of organic part of writing songs, writing a record, that all these things become incorporated as part of the process?
Very organic. It's very organic. The whole writing process is all combined with the production process, and just, you know, we try and be together when we're writing. I mean, we are together when we're writing, and mm-hmm. the songs evolve from maybe a sound or a rhythm, or maybe something more straight, like some actual real chords, which are then kind of layered up and maybe removed right at the end of the track anyway. But there's not a kind of stock process. We don't have a particular way of working. We just see how we're feeling and what inspires us on that day. And it might be lyrical or an emotion, or it might be a sound we've wanted to try.
I wanted to ask you, because on the new record, What Makes Us Glow, it seems more piano-led, maybe. It seemed to me like it might have been written on a piano.
If by piano you mean keyboards, then yeah. We did write, you know, some of the tracks were written on keyboards, and there was quite a lot of Wurlitzer on the album. Yeah.
But
I think
very
Kareem
different
said no Wurlitzer on the next one.
Yeah, but they had very different starting points, the track.
Yeah.
There was not like, because they've written over sort of a longer period of time. There wasn't sort of, we do three tracks on 2 days and start them the same way. They started from just that one noise we really liked, or a bunch of guitar chords that we recorded and chopped together and rearranged, or like keyboard chords. So it's very different. But then finally they all sort of get a sound that we sort of like, and I suppose that pulls them all together.
Yeah, I don't think we could write an album start with us the same starting point every time. I just don't think it would sort of satisfy us the way that we like the magic of a song suddenly turning into a song from nothing. And I think if you just start with piano and vocals, then it sort of builds quite an obvious way, if that makes sense. Mm. But it's much more exciting if you're using a bit of wood and some rubber bands, and somehow those things marry together and become more than the sum of their parts, and you start hearing melodies within them and chords within them, which you then might play to sort of strengthen those, to sort of, what's the word, underpin them, to mm-hmm. underpin those sounds, to, you know, underline them and make them into a stronger element of the song. But I'd rather write like that than sit down with a piano, although that's, you know, that's something that we like doing as well. But it's more exciting to not be working in the same way every time to create a track.
That was Sap, and the record What Makes Us Glow is out now. You're listening to Culture with me, Robert Bound. We're crossing now to New Delhi, where the 6th annual India Art Fair wrapped up recently, the centrepiece of a host of art events around the city, including launches, auctions and exhibitions. This year saw a far more upbeat mood than previous years, when the subcontinental art market was in a bit of a slump. Last year, when Monocle's New Delhi correspondent, Aarti Bettigeri, went along, she found some visiting galleries to be unhappy with the setup, infrastructure and commercial prospects presented by the fair. So, had anything changed for 2014? She went back to find out.
2013 was a difficult year for the Indian art market. Sales were down, and it appeared that the investor bubble that had been pierced a couple of years earlier was well and truly deflated. But just as the year came to a close, there was a remarkable turnaround. The international art house Christie's held its first auction of Indian art in Mumbai on December 20th and achieved some staggering prices. Overall sales topped $15 million US, doubling pre-sale estimates. And most notably, the auction garnered the highest price ever paid for a modern work of art sold in India. That was an untitled landscape by Indian artist Vasudeo Gaitonde, which sold for $3.7 million.
The way I see it is that people have come out of it with a new sense of assured confidence, based on real, true, cautious, perhaps a little slower, but long-term collecting. And people can certainly see that, you know, those who are in the market today are certainly long-term players and are interested in art in a very genuine sort of way. So I think those are the building blocks, really, for the market that are now falling into place.
Neha Kerpal is the founder of the India Art Fair. She launched the fair in 2008 at the start of the global economic downturn. Probably not the best time to begin an event that revolves around a commodity that's among the first to be cut loose when financial pressures strike. Since then, the fair has flourished, even moving to a custom-built structure in an outer suburb of the city. But that's not to say it doesn't have its fair share of detractors. Last year, vocal gallery owners told me they were disappointed with the support given to them by the fair in setting up their booths and in navigating India's difficult import and export regulations. But if there were similar concerns this year, no one was saying.
In every way, we have this fair has grown. The panel discussion, the quality of speakers, the attendance, the quality of buyers coming in, collectors coming in, and most important for us, the structural changes which Neha has got much more professional, and you know, the layout of the booths, the facilities given to us as participants. I mean, they're doing a very good job.
That's Renu Modi from Delhi's Gallery Espars, which has been here every year since the fair's inception. She, along with other gallery owners I spoke to, hailed fair organisers for being responsive to criticism and working hard to improve conditions. Now everyone agrees that the fair is on par with other international fairs. The booths are spacious and well-lit, the walkways are broad, and the layout is easy to navigate. And they're getting speakers from top museums around the world, another sign of the event's growing reputation.
We're here, I think it's the 5th year, but we're coming to the fair, and we're quite happy, and we saw the improving of the fair, step by step. And we're expecting that it be continued. I think it's important to not giving up after the first or second or even third year, and to install yourself in a country. And I think India is like really developing, so the market is growing, the artistic market as well.
That's Judith Peyra from Paris's Gallery Baudon Le Bon. Also back for another visit is Gallery Le Long, again from Paris.
It's our second time in India at the India Art Fair in New Delhi. We came back because we think that we should not come only once, and also because our experience was very interesting last year. So, and we want also to know more about the collectors here in India, the public collections, the private collections, and so on. And we can't learn and know everything in 1 year.
But it's telling that major international galleries like White Cube and the Lisson Gallery haven't returned after travelling to the fair a few years ago. However, insiders say that this is more likely to be a result of India's difficult customs requirements that can make it hard to move artworks in and out of the country.
The truth is, you know, there are very, very interesting artists coming out of China and India, which is generating excitement in Western collectors. But also China and India are inventing art worlds. The art world of the West is a rather old, sclerotic art world where we think we know how to do everything. But the truth is the art world's here, as is evident at India Art Fair, and as you, if you go to China you would see, is being invented by the private sector in new kinds of ways.
Philip Dodd represents the London-based trade group Made in China and is in Delhi leading a Chinese delegation. He says the art world is increasingly pivoting east.
Now, a cynical part of me says the reason the world's turning its face east is because there's money here and there's no money in the West, so they're out to find new patrons for old things that they're doing. But the truth is, this is an ineluctable shift of power. You know, in 1600, China was the most important place in the world. There's no doubt that Asia is the continent of the 21st century.
It's advised that artists, galleries and collectors alike would do well to heed. For Monocle in New Delhi, I'm Aarti Bettigheri.
And you're listening to Culture with me, Robert Bounds, on Monocle 24. Ever wondered how Iranian cinema operates? Well, we'll find out next.
All around the world, Monocle 24's growing network of correspondents bring you the latest news, reportage and insight. From New York to Nairobi, Bamako to Berlin.
For Monocle in Paris, I'm Tom Burgess-Watson.
For Monocle in Berlin, I'm Kimberly Bradley.
For Monocle in Pristina.
In New York.
In Cairo.
In Sao Paulo.
I'm Guy Delaunay.
For Monocle.
For Monocle.
In Tel Aviv.
For Monocle.
In San Francisco.
In North Vancouver.
In Ramallah.
I'm Aisha Spears.
I'm Joseph Dane.
For Monocle, I'm Sheena Rossiter.
In Bogota.
In London.
Bangkok.
Buenos Aires.
So whether you want to know what's happening in the corridors of power, in the boardrooms of the aviation giants, or the must-sees at the latest film festival, stay tuned to Monocle 24. Monocle 24, keeping an eye and an ear on the world.
Welcome back to Culture with me, Robert Bound. One of the few ways much of the world gets to interact with Iranian culture directly is through its film industry. From art house films such as Oscar-winning The Separation to blockbuster epics to rival Hollywood's offerings, the country's creatives have striven to turn Iran into an alternative cinema hub. The annual Faj Film Festival and Market came to a close this week, and one regular at the event is Anne Demi-Garreau, the founder of the Iranian Film Festival in Australia. She talked to Venetia Rainey about the birth of the Iranian movie industry.
Cinema under certain parts of the Shiite clergy is seen as haram or not pure. But the Ayatollah Khomeini, who had spoken against that kind of cinema when he was in exile, when he returned, decided that it was a good medium for actually re-educating the people. And this was something that he called for, the establishment of a pure Islamic cinema, one which could be used for helping the people, to educate the people, embracing pure Islamic kind of values and morality. Initially, it was very difficult for people to actually portray women because the constraints around the portrayal of women was something that was difficult to overcome. But it was around about 1990 that you start to see the presence of women on screen. And around about 1995, outside Iran, films started to be recognised. That was the year that Jafar Panahi won the Camera d'Or with The White Balloon. And from 1995 to 2000, there were just a huge number of prizes won internationally, including the Palme d'Or from Kiarostami.
روش خاک میریزی آدم نیست اونا یه آدم بود دیگه تو این چاله نبود.
Initially, they were perhaps free of politics, but around about 2000, people started to introduce politics into their themes. And this is the time when the government started to diverge from the aims of the filmmakers. So we had a period of about 10 years, really, from 2000 till about 2009, when the filmmakers were really rebelling against those kinds of constraints. And these are the films, of course, that we see in the cinemas outside of Iran.
So it's the ones that rebel against the government theme that make it out and get international attention?
Not entirely, but I would say about 90% of them. It can be really difficult. It depends. The Iranians are very used to the idea that they move around the system. And, I mean, we've heard all the stories. Even prior to the revolution, there was a film that was smuggled out of Iran to Venice, The Cow, the film that's often considered the first film of the Iranian New Wave. So 1969 already snuck out to Venice and screened unsubtitled. There are films, there are actually two different systems. There's the fact that people need an international screening permit, which is different from the domestic screening permit. So what happens sometimes is that they gain an international screening permit for a film that's banned in Iran, but then there are the films that are actually smuggled out. I think it's cultural diplomacy that they allow some of these films that they don't want screened inside to be actually screened outside.
And so you sort of started to mention women. Can we generalise about how women are depicted in Iranian cinema, or is it much more complex than that?
I think that you have the two different kinds of women. There are the educated women who are often very strong. I mean, that's the reality of Iran as well, and you see that within the films. But of course, the films that are conforming to government policy are showing much more the women who actually obey, who are good wives, good Muslim wives. And that's, as I say, the image that's portrayed. But then there are other films. For example, Jafar Panahi's very famous film Offside depicts the young girls who want to go to the soccer match and aren't allowed inside because women aren't allowed into the stadium. So of course they dress as men. It gets worse and worse. And that's the reality, and so that is screened in some of the films. But very often, of course, the films that are receiving government funding have to show a more conforming kind of one.
This is
Interestingly, it did have one screening in Iran at the Farsh Film Festival, and then it was banned. But he always says that this is the film of his that's the most seen in Iran, because of course the illegal DVD market takes care of all those kinds of issues.
That was Anne Demi-Garreau talking to Venetia Rainey. And that's just about all we have time for this week. Next time, we'll be enjoying a spritz and some Disco Italia as we delve into the next issue of Monocle magazine, all Italy-themed, and we'll ask what was hot at this year's Berlinale Film Festival. You've been listening to Culture with me, Robert Bound. My producer was Katie Bilboa, who was ably assisted by the mighty Holly Fisher, who blows the fake snow onto our unfortunately bald Sochi Winter Olympics. Time for one final song this week. They came, they saw, they drummed on a suitcase. This is Sap's final track from their Midori House session, and here they are with I Want That. Thanks for tuning in.
That there is something hiding in thee. I know you want it too, but can you take it? Can you take it? I want that, but come on and give it to me. Wrap it up in my palm and let me take it, knowing me I'll break it. Ribbon and a bow, 'cause you never ever know what is gonna happen. No, I want that. No, I want that. No, I want that. Can fill it to the brim. I wanna take you on a whim. Gonna make you like it. Let's go out and find us something hiding in me. I know you want it too, but can you take it? Can you take it? Search for trinkets on an empty beach. I know I want that. I've got a handful of kaleidoscopes. I know I want that. I've got a hammer and a mallet bro. I know I want that. I know I want that. Whoa, I really